Welcome to New World Notes, edited by Kenneth Doust. Today, part one of a witty and brilliant talk on imperialism that Michael Peretti gave back in 1994. That's how we'll celebrate the 30th anniversary of Operation Urgent Fury. Don't remember Operation Urgent Fury? Shame on you, and please stay tuned. The American media love to celebrate anniversaries with round numbers. Truth be told, last year's 200th anniversary celebration of the glorious War of 1812 was a bit of a dud. Maybe because the war itself was a bit of a dud, fought for no good reason and accomplishing nothing good. Much like the glorious World War I, whose 100th anniversary we shall celebrate in 2014. But right now, we have another anniversary of another glorious American war to celebrate, the 30th anniversary of Operation Urgent Fury. Our military's Urgent Fury was directed against the new left-wing government of the island nation of Grenada. And, for once, the U.S. military scored a decisive victory over the evil forces of our enemy. We successfully smashed Grenada's threat to the world's capitalist system. That's 30 years ago, as of October 25. Our glorious military victory over Grenada. Could you find the island nation of Grenada on a map? Well, no matter. It's there. In the Caribbean, east of Aruba, a bit north of Trinidad and Tobago. I've been planning to broadcast some of the great classic talks by progressive political scientist Michael Peretti, talks he gave back in the mid-1990s. My first selection was his talk, The Costs of Empire, from 1994. We will hear this week and next. By happy coincidence, early in the talk, Peretti spends some time discussing Grenada. Peretti was among the first scholars to state that the United States is an imperial power, that it operates an empire. The idea is familiar now, but back in 1994, nobody was acknowledging it. Almost nobody, apart from Peretti, Gore Vidal, and Chalmers Johnson. In the first half of his talk, Peretti makes these main points. First, the U.S. is an empire. But the purpose of the empire is not national glory. The purpose of the empire is to maximize the profits of U.S.-based multinational corporations. Indeed, maintaining an empire is ruinously expensive. But the Fortune 500 aren't paying for it. You are. And, like a parasite, an empire will bleed dry the republic in which it is based. Happened in Rome, happened in Spain, happened in England, happening here. Speaking in Palo Alto in November 1994, here is Michael Peretti with part one of The Costs of Empire at Home and Abroad.
I'm going to talk about empire. And I'm going to talk about the U.S. empire. And that's a rather strange subject because most people, most academics would not recognize a U.S. empire. I mean, there was a British empire, a Roman empire, a Soviet empire. But a U.S. empire, that seems just too strange. But when you think about it, the United States today maintains the largest global military apparatus in the history of humanity. In fact, the only global one. It's the only one that spans the entire globe. The U.S. has 350 major military bases in some 80 foreign countries, along with about 800 other minor installations in various countries. It has a naval fleet greater in tonnage and firepower than all the other navies combined. It has nuclear-armed this fleet. It sails every ocean. It makes port on every continent, just about. It has bomber squadrons, thousands of nuclear missiles, Rapid deployment forces with enough destructive force to obliterate entire populations, as we saw happen in Iraq. A good 100,000 people killed in the first couple of weeks of fighting. In fact, enough destructive force in the U.S. armed forces to obliterate the planet itself. In addition, this U.S. empire has auxiliaries, just as the Roman Empire used to take native troops and arm them and set them up. The U.S. empire has given more than $200 billion in military aid to train, equip, and subsidize over 2 million troops and internal security forces in over as 80 countries. The purpose is being not to defend them from outside invasion, but to defend the ruling oligarchs in these countries from their own populations. Among the recipients of U.S. military aid have been some of the worst murderers and military autocracies on earth, such as Turkey, Zaire, Chad, Morocco, Kuwait, Indonesia, and others too numerous to mention. Haiti, before Aristide and after Aristide. Over the past four decades, the U.S. launched or assisted in the overthrow of popular governments in Guatemala, Guyana, Brazil, Chile, Uruguay, Greece, Argentina, Bolivia, and Haiti in 91, and numerous other countries, and then supported the conservative military autocracies that replaced them. Well, now, if a goal of U.S. foreign policy is democracy, how do you serve the cause of democracy throughout the world by overthrowing so many democracies? And why did you overthrow them? The U.S. national security state, we're going to answer that question. That's not a rhetorical question. That's not a scold. That's a question to be analyzed. The U.S. national security state has participated in covert actions or brutal mercenary wars against revolutionary governments in Cuba, Angola, Mozambique, Nicaragua, Cambodia, East Timor, Western Sahara, South Yemen, and elsewhere, often with dreadful devastation and loss of life for the indigenous populations. One-sixth of Mozambique's land is cultivated today. In other words, five-sixths of the cultivated land has been wiped out or uninhabitable, made unsafe because of RENAMO and the murderers. In Angola, literally hundreds of thousands have died. 1.5 million people have died in Angola in a CIA-sponsored war. Almost 200,000 have died since that very last election, which UNITA would not recognize because they ran the election, they lost it, and they went back to fighting. Almost 200,000 people. You don't hear about that in the media. We hear about Bosnia, Bosnia, Bosnia. Bosnia is almost a sideshow compared to the kind of killing that's going on in Angola. And there's a reason why you don't hear about it. It's because Angola is a U.S.-sponsored war. And so you don't hear about all the people that are being killed in our free and independent media. Hostile actions by the U.S. leaders have been directed against reformist governments in Egypt, South Yemen, Lebanon, Peru, Iran under Mossadegh, the Congo under Lumumba, the Fiji Islands, and you can go on. Since World War II, U.S. military forces have directly invaded or launched aerial attacks, killing large numbers of people in Vietnam, the Dominican Republic, Laos, Cambodia, Lebanon, Grenada, Panama, Libya, Iraq, and Somalia. Before World War II, the U.S. invaded Haiti, Soviet Russia, China, Nicaragua, Cuba, Mexico, Puerto Rico, the Philippines. I'll bet you most school kids would be surprised to hear that last one invaded all those different countries. The U.S. has done that. They fought a whole war in China. In fact, I looked at the old records of veterans from the 1898, and there was a special category. Did you fight in the Spanish War, the Filipino War, the Boxer Rebellion? U.S. troops were in China fighting. I didn't learn about this in school. I didn't learn about it at Yale graduate school. You get a PhD in political science and you're political illiterate and historical illiterate. They don't tell you what your country has been doing in the world. I mean, you think one of the minimal things you're going to learn is what your country does in the world, especially if you take courses that say U.S. foreign policy and the world, right? You would think you'd learn something about this. Take those courses and never learn what the U.S. has been doing. And by the U.S., I mean the U.S. leaders. By the way, intervention takes other forms. The U.S. national security state finances hundreds of publishing houses, wire services, publications, and other propaganda channels, hundreds of research institutions, conservative political parties, and compliant labor unions, rigged elections, and the like. Why does a professedly peace-loving nation find it necessary to use so much force, violence, and manipulation against so many peoples in so many places, and what's been the cost to the U.S. population itself? That is the question that informs my talk tonight. The nations that feel the brunt of U.S. intervention are not randomly selected. Generally, intervention is directed against governments that have sought to establish political economic independence. Governments that have either tried to drop out of the global free market capitalist system or within the confines of it tried some kind of independent development and redistributive politics. By redistributive politics, I mean that they took some portion of the gross national income and redistributed from column A to column B. From the people in column A, that 2% that live off interest and dividends and land royalties and rents, to the people in column B, the other 98% who live off wages, salaries, commissions, fees, and pensions. And those are the governments, those governments that have pursued that kind of policy are the ones which have been targeted for U.S. intervention. It could be a populist military government, as in Panama under Torrijo and Noriega, or in Egypt under Nasser. It could be a Christian revolutionary one, as in Nicaragua under the Sandinistas. It could be a social democratic popular front government, as in Chile under Allende, or in Greece under Papandreou back in the 1960s. It could be a Marxist-Leninist one, as in Cuba or North Korea or Soviet Union. It could be an Islamic revolutionary government, as in Libya under Gaddafi. Even a conservative militarist government, as in Iraq under Saddam Hussein. I mean, Saddam Hussein was CIA. I mean, who do you think brought him in and got the king out of Iraq? It was the CIA. But he got to be a little too nationalistic. He started to get out of line on oil prices and oil quotas. The goal of U.S. global policy is to make the world safe for the Fortune 500. The purpose is not just to protect direct investments. I mean, there was very little direct investment, U.S. investment in Vietnam, for instance, or in Soviet Russia back in 1920 when the U.S. invaded with 12 other countries. It's to protect the overall global capitalist system. Take the case of Grenada. I remember saying to an acquaintance, I said, why doesn't Reagan invade Grenada? I mean, here's a little revolutionary country of 102,000 people. It's perfectly helpless, and he's a bully, and he would take it, you know, and it's trying a revolutionary course. And then I came to the conclusion, and it was foolish of me to say this, I said, oh, it's too small. It's ridiculous to go take U.S. forces and invade. And I didn't realize that nothing's too small for Ronald Reagan. And sure enough, he invaded Grenada. Well, what's the purpose of it? Capitalism would not collapse if Grenada remained revolutionary. And Reagan was right. It wasn't a matter of direct resources that you needed from that country. He said, nutmeg is not the question. I mean, that was Grenada's biggest export. We could get perfectly good nutmeg from Africa. You don't need Grenada's nutmeg. So why did they invade Grenada? They invaded Grenada because they were serving notice to the people of the Caribbean and to the people of Latin America and to the people of the world that you cannot drop out of your client state free market system. That if you try to take an independent source, and that if you use your land, your labor, your resources, and your capital, and your markets in a different way, in a collectivist way, if you use them to benefit the needs of your people rather than to be milked like a cow for foreign investors or whatever else, if you do that, this is what's going to happen to you. And the rest of the Caribbean got the message. In the same way, the reason Indonesia invaded East Timor. There may be oil in East Timor, or there may not. But the thing that there was a revolutionary government that was trying to effect these kinds of social changes. And this counter-revolutionary policy prevails regardless of the party or personality that's in the White House. Whether it's a Democrat or a Republican, it doesn't matter. This policy obtains. The present leader, as you know, Mr. Clinton, was a member of the Trilateral Commission, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and a member of the Bilderberg Conference. I mean, he's right in there in the national security state policy elite circles when he came into office. The process of keeping the world's land, labor, resources accessible at cheap prices for the multinational investors, that process has a name. It's called imperialism, the I word, which is really not allowed to be mentioned very often. And if you're practicing imperialism, then you have an empire. So in its financial and in its military reach, the United States empire builders have created the greatest empire in history, far greater in scope and power than Great Britain in the 19th century or Rome of ancient times. Now, the most common hegemonic mode today is not direct colonialization. It's a new form which developed in the past century. It's given different names. It's called informal empire, colonialism without colonies, neo-colonialism, or neo-imperialism. And the first practitioners of the new form, the variation is you don't directly go in and conquer the country and hold it and occupy it and put your flag up and say, this is one of our possessions. We did that. We were in Cuba. Remember, we went to Cuba. We were the first practitioners, the most significant. It's not the very first example historically, but it's the most significant example, was in Cuba in 1898, where we took over Cuba in 1904, is actually about five years later. We turned to the Cubans and we said, well, we stole you fair and square from the Spaniards, but we're a republic and it doesn't look good if we have a colony. So we're going to give you your independence. And you're going to have your own flag. It's going to be red, white, and blue. You're going to have just one star on it because you're just a little island, you know. And you get your own presidente and you get your own currency. You don't have to put George Washington on. You can put Jose Marti or any other Cuban we find acceptable. And you have your own Guardia Civil, and they'll keep your people in line, and we'll train them, and we'll give them their guns, and we'll give them nice uniforms and all that sort of thing. And so you'll be independent, and all we will have is we'll own your tobacco industry, your sugar industry, your nickel mines, and your oil refineries, and we'll control all your imports and exports. And you won't be allowed to make any treaties with third countries. You have to deal with us. But other than that, you're independent. So that's neo-colonialism, where you give them the bills and the overhead costs and you skim the cream. Because ultimately, all these guys want is the cream. Now, some places the U.S. still exercises direct colonial rule, as in Puerto Rico, for instance. Now that's what I say is the motive force behind U.S. interventionism. In most instances. If these assertions aren't true, then what is the evidence to support an alternative view? Why has the United States never supported social revolutionary forces against right-wing autocracies? Why does it harp on the absence of Western democratic forms in certain anti-capitalist countries while ignoring brutal and widespread human rights violations in pro-capitalist countries? Why do U.S. leaders aid dozens of pro-capitalist military autocracies around the world and assist in their campaigns to repress democratic organizations within their own countries? Why have our leaders withheld aid and even attacked democratic reformist governments as in Guatemala, Chile, Nicaragua, and elsewhere? Why has the United States overthrown more than a dozen democratically elected reformist governments in the last 40 years and an almost equal number of left populist regimes that were making modest moves against the prerogatives of corporate capital? Why did it do these things before there ever was a Soviet Union? And why does it continue to do them even after the Soviet Union and most other communist powers have disappeared? Why has it supported and collaborated with narcotics traffickers from Laos to Afghanistan to Guatemala while conjuring imaginary drug dealings in Cuba? Why has it shown hostility toward every anti-capitalist party, movement, or government, including ones that play by the democratic rules and have persistently sought normal diplomatic and economic relations with the USA? These questions, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, are never asked. These questions are never answered or discussed in what passes for political discourse in our media and among our political leaders and public officials when they speak in public, in any case. And the public is not encouraged to question, because the empire's survival depends on its ability to expropriate the resources of the republic for its overseas expansion. Its survival depends on its being able to dip into the wealth here, to take from you so that the patricians may pursue their far-off plunder. It's true of every empire. The center is bled so that the periphery may be expanded. U.S. leaders have to convince the people that the immense costs of empire which they sustain are necessary for their security and survival. First, it was to defend us from the Red Menace with its headquarters in Moscow. We had to win the superpower arms race, contain Soviet aggression. There were these communist aggressions coming at us from all sides. Remember that? The Soviets might just sweep down from Nova Scotia. The Angolans might come up through North Carolina. The Vietnamese would land in California. That's not such a joke. I remember during the Vietnam War, they said that. They used to say, we have to fight them in the jungles of Vietnam, or we will have to fight them on the beaches of California. The Cubans would come up and take Miami. The Cubans already did take Miami. Now, with the Soviet Union gone, our leaders assert that there are a host of other adversaries, other ones, who are ready to pounce on us, who apparently had been overlooked just a few years ago. Defense Secretary Cheney said, the world out there is full of evil adversaries, ready to pounce on us, to get us. And I always say, why are they out to get us? I mean, why don't they ever pounce on Denmark, let's say, or Brazil, or New Zealand, like they have other places. I mean, New Zealand's sticking way out there all by itself in the Pacific. Why are they going to pounce on us? And who gave the United States national security state the right to dictate to all other governments what kinds of economic systems they can have? Well, we have to defend our interests. That's what I hear, too. And when we say our interests are being protected overseas, you know, our interests, I hear that all the time. What are our interests? When are they going to define those interests? Certainly, our sons and daughters might have to participate in the overseas ventures. Our taxes are needed to finance the ventures. I remember on the eve of the Gulf War, I heard that our oil, we had to defend our oil in the Middle East. And I got very excited, you know. I ran over to my filing cabinet to whip out my stock portfolio and see, and I was dismayed to find that I didn't even have a stock portfolio. So, I have oil in the Middle East, present. And then I realized, of course, that George Bush and his sons were probably holding it in trust for me. When third world peoples, through nationalization or revolution or both, take over the oil in their own land, the copper in their own land, the tin, the sugar, whatever else, it doesn't hurt the interests of our people. They'd be willing to sell it to us. And at prices, incidentally, they'd probably be a lot more reasonable than what the corporate 500 sells it to us about. Nationalization won't hurt us, but nationalization certainly would hurt the multinational conglomerates who believe that they and only they should control and own and refine and market and get rich off these resources. We're made to believe that the people of the United States has a community of interest with the giant corporate investors. In fact, the national policies of an imperialist country reflect the interests of that country's dominant socioeconomic class. Class, I'm arguing, class rather than nation-state, is often the crucial unit of analysis in the study of imperialism. And if you understand that, you avoid the mistakes of a lot of liberal writers who repeatedly point out, for instance, that empire costs too much, that it's irrational. It's been pointed out that from 1950 to 1970, the U.S. government gave the Philippines $3 billion in aid, when the U.S. has only $1 billion of investments in the Philippines. You see, it's irrational. It costs more than what we're getting back. That's the liberal view. Now, if you think with Marx, if you think in terms of class, you understand that that's not irrational at all. Because the people who are paying the $3 billion are not the same people as the people who have the $1 billion investment. The people who are paying the $3 billion are us. And the people who have the $1 billion investment are Exxon and ITT and IBM and General Dynamics and General Motors and General Electric and all the other generals. And they'll spend $3 of your money to protect $1 of their money. They'll spend $4 of your money, $5, $6. In fact, when it comes to protecting their money, your money is no object. Consider the overlooked class dimensions of foreign aid. When it says the U.S. gives aid to whoever, Guatemala. A country as such doesn't give aid to another country as such. It's the people of a country who have to fork up the money, and then that money is given to a specific set of people in the other country, often oligarchs with very sticky fingers. Aid that's going to go into the little villages and help the little people ends up in Swiss bank accounts. Ask General Cedras, who's leaving Haiti now with his bank accounts. As someone once said, foreign aid is when the poor people of a rich country, that's us, give money to the rich people of a poor country. So the transference is not only across national lines, it's also across class lines and represents an upward redistribution of income.
Michael Parenti, in a classic speech from 1994, The Costs of Empire. Tune in next week for part two. For the original recording, our thanks to Sue Soriano and People's Video Audio. And thanks to RadioForAll.net for keeping this recording available. And thank you for listening to New World Notes. We come to you from the East of the River Satellite Studios and Skunk Works of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. You can download all of our shows from our website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. On behalf of the entire New World Notes staff, this is Kenneth Doust, wishing you a good week, advising illegitimi non carborundum, and suggesting support your local farmers market and bicycle shop. Ciao.